Welcome to The Safety Break, the Whitewater Rescue Podcast. We're here to share stories of real river accidents and rescues and find expert advice on how to solve the problems you might encounter in the Whitewater River environment. I'm your host, Jack Diddy, an emergency medicine physician, whitewater paddler, and wilderness medicine educator. Together, I hope we can celebrate successful rescues and learn from our mistakes in a supportive environment. If you have a story to share of a non-fatal accident or rescue, send me an email at thesafetybreak@gmail.com or contact me on our Facebook page, The Safety Break. If you like what you hear, hit the subscribe button and follow us on social media. I hope you learned something valuable in the show.
There's no other option at that point. You're not going to leave your friend.
Popped up, you know, kind of slung the water out of my eyes, and I was already going under this big boulder.
You know, we're trying to move as fast as possible, too, because, you know, we don't know how long Clay can hold on.
So, I just kind of took that leap of faith.
You know, it's no fucking around. It's just like business time at that point. We're just problem solving.
In this episode, we hear about a harrowing experience on the Rio Topo. Known for its incredible diversity of terrain and wildlife, rich cultural resources, and an amazing collection of rivers, Ecuador is one of the best vacation paddling destinations on the planet. Most of the rivers have a friendly vibe if you catch them at a reasonable flow, but every now and then they can bite. At around 5,000 feet elevation, the Topo drains the southern aspect of Yanganates National Park, one of the last truly great wilderness areas on Earth. It emerges briefly near the town of Baños, and then drops deeply into the jungle to join the Amazon. This accident occurred just after New Year's in 2019, with the river flowing at a low to medium flow on a class 4 to 5 section of river. The group consisted of 7 solid and seasoned paddlers, though only a few had seen the section of river previously. At the time, most in the group were unaware of the sieve hazard featured in this story. It came near the end of the run, near the confluence with the Rio Pastaza. We're going to hear from 3 different paddlers within the group, and I've edited their interviews to pull it together to tell a cohesive story. After you hear the details of the accident, keep listening as we discuss a few more technical details of the rescue. I hope you can find some valuable learning points from our discussion. So let's go ahead and meet our guests. First, we have Art Barquette.
Thanks, man. Thanks for having me.
Art is a paddler from the Mid-Atlantic region and is currently working on a new guidebook to the creeks of West Virginia and some of the surrounding areas. Keep an eye out for that next year. Next, we have Clay Warren. Clay is a longtime friend of mine from Kentucky and one of the many colorful cast of characters that you might run into at the Russell Fork.
Nice to be here. Nice to get to chat with you. Our chats are few and far between these days, it seems.
Clay is a dentist, and his mantra has always been, clean teeth equals clean lines. So I had one burning question for him. On the morning of this incident, did you forget to brush your teeth?
I feel certain I failed to brush my teeth this particular day because I was certainly not having the cleanest of lines. I try to practice that philosophy and actually not only brush, but also floss before getting on the river. So I would certainly advise others to follow suit.
Finally, we have a former colleague of mine in the ER, Allie Metz.
I'm Allie Metz. I'm 31. I live in White Salmon these days, specifically BZ Corner, the Trust Takeout.
Allie is an ER and ICU nurse, a climber, paddler, and as you'll see in this story, a great person to have in your crew on the river. Her climbing skills were the backbone of this rescue. There's a couple other people mentioned in the story. John Moore is one of them. He has a YouTube page called John Moore on Camera, which features head cam runs of multiple rivers, including this one. It doesn't show footage of the accident, but you can get a good sense of the river character and a brief glimpse of the sieve. So, let's hear the story. Here's Art.
Well, me and John Moore, we're going to do a trip together. We had done a couple trips before together, and so we decided to head down. And this is my first time in Ecuador. He had been there about 15 years prior. And then the other guys I all met down there, you know, we started paddling in Baeza, which is in like the Quios Valley. And we did a couple runs there before moving on to Tena. And after Tena, we went to Baños, which is the town where, you know, the incident took place on the Rio Topo. And the Rio Topo is a really great class 4+ boulder run. It's It's partially dammed. The upper part of the topo is dammed, but the lower part is kind of free flowing. So that's the section we were paddling that day.
The topo just has a little more ominous feel to it. And, you know, when it was originally described to me, it was a good step up from, you know, most of the stuff in the Quijos Valley, step up from the Oyakachi, you know, and I definitely noticed, you know, there were several huge boulders that formed, you know, sieves or caves, that sort of thing on the run.
It felt really like engaging, but also really fun to me, you know, stacked with moves and at times smaller eddies and just boulder garden-y and steep in the sense that you had to like follow the leader pretty well.
We were just kind of hopping down and really wasn't a big deal, you know, until we had the incident.
I definitely was not really on my game. I don't know if it was maybe still from a hangover from New Year's or you know what, but I just wasn't feeling at the top of my game.
We were approaching the, you know, this rapid and had a little like, you know, class 3-4, a little bit tricky lead in, and we were just following one after another. Like there really wasn't a lot of beta, you know, given, and we're just kind of following a line, making our way down. Everybody's heading for this one little like narrow line. So there's kind of like a blockade of boulders in front of us with like one narrow waterfall line. It's kind of like a little spout, but it was only maybe a little bit more than a boat width wide. And I guess the issue was we basically all ran the rapid. Clay was the last one, and I'm down at the bottom shooting photos, and just to the right of where this waterfall line was, there's like a big boulder. And then between that boulder and the bank, there's just a huge siphon. I mean, this thing was swallowing probably like 2/3 of the flow of the river right there. And really wasn't until I got down below that I looked up and saw like how big and how much water was flowing through this siphon. I set up and I'm taking a couple pictures, looking upstream, and I see Clay, he's up there, and I see him flip over, you know, in the lead-in rapid. And he ends up swimming, you know, from the vantage point I had, I could see him swimming towards it, and then I don't see him anymore. So at this point, we're all, basically all of us like kind of see this happen and we're panicking, you know, cause we expected him to flush through the siphon, you know, with the boat.
I remember the feeling of standing below and the sound of the river, the Ecuadorian jungle, watching Clay's boat come through. And no Clay. And I was like, Clay's dead.
I was certainly unaware of this big sieve off to the right. You know, you could see there's this just massive boulder overhanging the right, you know, off the right bank. And the move is to kind of skip down this little slide over a little, you know, hole at the bottom of the slide and basically just go straight forward through this tight little notch where you can just more or less boof off of a, I'd say 6 or 8 foot, you know, vertical boof. When I was, you know, entering down this little slide, the bow of my boat hits, you know, some sort of a dry area of the slide. I ended up getting turned completely sideways and getting in, you know, landing in a side surf. And really, I should have been able to work my way out of it without any problem. But, you know, as the day had unfolded, I was just not feeling super strong and super confident. I'd already, you know, flipped, I think, once or twice upstream prior to that and just wasn't feeling like I was on my game that day. You know, I was leaning downstream and I just kept leaning more and more downstream until I, you know, ultimately flipped over. More or less, I basically just carped a roll and carped a second one. So I ended up pulling my skirt and swimming. And literally as soon as I surfaced, I was deflecting off to the right and going over under this massive boulder. And my boat was just out of arm's reach from me. The boat hit the back of that, I'm going to call it a cave or an overhanging boulder. it hit the back of that, turned straight, you know, perpendicular to the horizon, and was gone, out of sight, nowhere to be seen. And at that moment, I knew that I did not want to follow suit. You know, I didn't know if there was, you know, trees down in this drain. I was also worried that my boat may have plugged up whatever was down there, and I didn't know where it went, you know. Fortunately, kind of, you know, I feel like I grew cat claws there for a second, and there was these two branches that were probably 6 inches in diameter. They were positioned just perfectly that I was able to grab hold of them. And that was, honestly, that was my lifeline, because I don't think I would have been able to grab hold of the boulder, you know, any part of the rock, because it was fairly smooth and over, you know, basically overhanging. And the current was pulling me very, very strongly, you know, to the same fate as my boat.
So it takes us like several minutes to, we start panicking, looking for him, and we're still waiting for him to come out, you know, like, you know, what's happening? Where is he? And so we go ferry over to the other side and start making our way up through there. And in the banks of this river, it's kind of like jungle, heavily vegetated, full of big boulders and stuff. So we're kind of crawling through that vegetation, and I have to go around this big boulder, and I get out, you know, up above the rapid. And at that point, I still couldn't see him, but I waded out, looked downstream, and I could see him there. He was clinging to the logs that was like leading into the siphon, just, you know, holding on for dear life there.
You know, my head was beating up against this the roof of this boulder. I was up to my neck in water. And I didn't realize it at first, you know, but I was having to flex my entire core, both arms and legs. I knew that I was going to hang on as long as my body could, you know, feasibly withstand it. I did not ever consider letting go. You know, I did take little short breaks where I was blowing my whistle, but, you know, the roar of that rapid, the roar of the river, the fact that I was under this, you know, huge boulder, they said that they did not hear us, you know, anything. Finally, and I'm pretty sure it was Denver and Art, kind of made a harrowing jump out onto a rock, you know, in the river upstream, and that was really probably the only vantage point that anyone could get to where they could actually see me. I knew at that point that my crew was going to get me out of there, but I knew it wasn't going to be easy.
And I make it upstream, and I wade out into the middle of the river with Art, and we get into the middle of the river, and I see coming out of the cave, it's just like the tip of Clay's paddle. And it's like waving in the air. And that was the first time I realized that Clay was still alive. And at that point, maybe he'd been there for 20 minutes.
I look downstream, you know, I make contact with him. And the first thing I think to do is, you know, let me get him a rope. And I actually do throw him a rope. But the rope is like basically worthless. He doesn't even want to take it, you know, wisely. Because, again, if he would have grabbed the rope and let go of the log, he would have just got pulled right through the siphon, just the amount of force that was going through there. There's no way I could have pulled him up against the current.
The vector that they would be pulling me at would basically pendulum me directly right into the sieve. And I knew that the only way out was to go like immediately like 180 degrees behind me. Like the exact way I went in was the exact way I was going to have to come out. I think I finally got the message to him that throwing that rope to me from that angle was just not an option, that I needed someone down there behind me.
He told me about how he had tried to throw a rope to Clay, and how he didn't want to grab onto it, it seemed like. And I agreed with that sentiment. And we came to the conclusion, we're like, that someone would have to rappel down to Clay.
At that point, I kind of like, I'm just looking around, assessing the situation. I see there, like, there's this huge boulder that kind of overhangs the siphon. And this is like a boulder on the backside. and it's a big, big giant boulder, has a tree growing on top, bunch of vegetation on it. So I kind of quickly get the idea that, you know, maybe we can lower a rope down or lower somebody down, and actually, you know, get right to them. You know, we're trying to move as fast as possible too, because we know, you know, we don't know how long Clay can hold on.
Anyway, I was, you know, kind of getting to that point where I was having to like lift one of my feet off of my little stable spot just so I could rest individual muscle groups. So I was, you know, more or less just taking a break for 30 seconds at a time with each, you know, left leg, right arm, left leg, just kind of going in a circle. Going through that sieve was not an option for me until I was just, you know, until I was so beat down and dead tired that I couldn't hold on any longer. So I just hung in there.
On top of the boulder, there was one tree that I remember looking like a somewhat viable option to anchor on and rappel off of, but it was probably the size of my calf, and it was on top of a boulder in the Ecuador jungle. So not something that you really would ever choose as an anchor. As I was like coming over the edge and I saw that there was like 20 feet below me, I thought, well, if at least this rope holds me for the first like 10 feet, that means I only have to fall 10 more feet and I can probably be okay if I fall that distance. The most important thing is that I'm just like down at that boulder and able to reach Clay. And that's really all I cared about. So I didn't really care about how shitty it all was, because there was no other option. There's no other option at that point. You're not going to leave your friend down there. So I rappelled down. I was pretty nervous the whole time. When I rappel down, I just start yelling at Clay. I'm like, Clay, I'm coming for you. Like, hang on. And he's just like yelling. He's like, Allie, you know. It's the first time I can hear him in the whole, like, past 30 or 45 minutes that has passed. And then I land down on the rock, and then it's just, you know, it's no fucking around. It's just like business time at that point. And we're just problem solving. I took his paddle from him, and I had taken a 6-foot loop of webbing that was wrapped around my waist, and I took that off my waist and I threw it to Clay. And it was kind of just like this moment of truth, right? You know, where he's, I can't see him. He can't see me. We can barely hear each other. And he's 6 feet away from me. And he has to let go of whatever he's holding on to on the sieve. And then we like count to three and I pull him towards me.
I had to make, you know, kind of a momentary decision there, you know, and I knew it was the only decision I could make, to reach back, grab that piece of webbing, and just trust that she, you know, had the strength and the stability to pull me back, you know, essentially upstream, you know, to the current. What I did have to do was let go of this purchase that I was very precariously attached to, and so I knew that, you know, once I did that, the odds of me, you know, especially given the fact that my legs were completely numb. I was exhausted and mentally, you know, exhausted as well, that, you know, it's going to be hard for me to save myself again if I did not, you know, grab that piece of webbing. So I just took that leap of faith and kind of made a lunge for it.
And as soon as he gets close enough, I pull him up by his PFD, and he like puts his arms around me, and then he looks at me and he's like, I knew you were gonna save me. After I pulled him out, he couldn't feel his legs or his feet. And So we had to sit there for a while, and then we ended up squirrel jumping, is what I call it, just like belly flopping out to the river below us because we weren't sure about depth. And we had people downstream of us that threw us ropes and pendulumed us into an eddy. And then we ferried over to river left and hiked out. I hiked out with Clay and everybody else paddled down. But I think we were both pretty over it at that point.
What I will say is when I woke up the next morning, I could barely get out of bed. It was like, I don't know what it feels like to do a plank, you know, for an hour, but like every muscle in my body was sore, fatigued, you know, and I took a couple of days off from paddling.
I mean, it had to have been at least 35, 40 minutes, I think, that he was holding on that long. There's all that waiting time. We're figuring out what's happening. I had to ferry upstream, crawl through the jungle, wade out to him. And then by the time we figured out what to do, got up there, set up all this rope, I'm sure it must have felt like an eternity to Clay.
Whitewater paddlers are often operating in pretty difficult terrain. I think it's worth asking ourselves if we'd be prepared to deal with the type of rescue encountered in this story. Do you have the knowledge, the skills, and the gear to make this kind of rescue happen quickly? I wanted to explore more of the technical details of the rappel with Allie, as I think there's a lot to learn there. One thing to keep in mind is that the setup described here is dangerous. It was used here as a last-ditch measure to save someone's life. I think it's worth knowing about, it's worth practicing, but should really only be used in desperate scenarios. Before doing any vertical rope work, it's worth getting some formal instruction. Your local climbing gym can usually point you in the right direction for this. Let's hear more from Allie. Her climbing experience played a huge role in this rescue.
I didn't start rock climbing until I was like 18 or 19. And I went out climbing in Sand Rock, Alabama with my friend's boyfriend in college. And then it turned into, like, from there, I just like was obsessed. And eventually, like, started working at the climbing gym, became a climbing instructor, climbing guide. And yeah, just was totally, it was my world before I even knew what kayaking was. Friday nights, we had safety Fridays at the climbing gym, and we would create little practice rescue scenarios and practice doing like single pitch pickoffs or different rescue scenarios. So like what I did with Clay that day, I'd already practiced in a gym, like in a safe environment, years prior, many times.
Usually to set up a rappel, you need a rope, a harness, an ATC or other rappel device, an anchor of some sort, and a few locking carabiners. Here, Allie describes how they approached this problem with the limited equipment that they had available.
I probably just like girth hitched a sling around the tree, threw a carabiner on. I had an Astral PFD rope that I used to rappel off of. And I was worried about the integrity of the tree. So I had them also tie a rope to the tree and pull. So when I was going to rappel, there was three people pulling like counter traction because I was that nervous about the tree. I put on my PFD and used it as a harness and clipped in. So I just put it on like a diaper, and there's a, on the front of the Astral Green Jacket on the bottom, there's like a loop of webbing, but I knew it was probably rated enough to at least hang statically from it, which is all I was doing.
I reached out to our friends over at Astral to find out more about the technical specifications of the gear that was involved here. The rope Allie was using was a 7mm Dyneema throw rope with a static load capacity of 1,800 pounds, so certainly strong enough for this scenario. She was using her PFD as a waist harness, essentially turning it upside down, stepping into it, and then securing it around her waist. The representative that I spoke with from Astral wanted to make it clear that it really wasn't designed or intended to be used in this fashion, so they couldn't comment on its merits when used in this way. However, they were very helpful providing the results of load testing of the various components of the life jacket. These numbers come from the required independent testing by Underwriters Laboratory, or UL. You may notice this abbreviation printed on your PFD with the buoyancy rating. On the Astral Green Jacket, the plastic side buckles are the limiting factor in its load capacity when worn correctly. They passed a load test of 300 pounds for 5 minutes. The quick-release rescue harness must pass a minimum load test of 730 pounds. So I think you would really want to have that quick-release rescue harness attached if you were stressing the limits of the jacket. A very reliable and lightweight harness can also be improvised just from a long loop of webbing, attached around the waist and between the legs, clipped in the middle with a locking carabiner. This is a pretty lightweight option to carry with you in your boat. When you're on rappel, you have to create friction in the rope to control your descent. This is usually accomplished with an ATC or other rappel device. Luckily, it can be improvised with a Munter hitch.
So a Munter hitch is half of a clove hitch, and it allows you to rappel or belay someone in the event that you drop a belay device or don't have one.
The Munter hitch is worth knowing about, and I've linked a video on our Facebook page that describes it and shows it in detail. When using this, it's probably a good idea to back it up with a prusik. There's a good discussion of this technique in the book River Rescue by Les Bechtel and Slim Ray. They describe a famous rescue on the Ocoee River in 1982 using a similar technique, which also saved the life of a paddler trapped on a bridge pylon. I didn't have time to include the full interview with Clay, but he expressed to me much gratitude to the entire crew that pulled him out. Art, Allie, Denver Herod, John Moore, Tara Nathan, and Melissa Vaughn. Thanks for bringing Clay back in one piece. As this episode goes to press, it's mid-January, which is high season for Ecuador paddling. If you're heading out to the Topo, stay on your A-game as you approach that rapid near the end of the run. Thanks to our three guests for trusting me with their story today. Keep an eye out for Art's new West Virginia guidebook when it becomes available next year. And remember, clean teeth equals clean lines. Make sure to brush and floss before putting on the river. And if you see Allie, make sure to buy her a beer. This story illustrated several common themes among successful rescues. Never giving up, quick problem solving and improvisation, and solid group teamwork. In our next two episodes, we'll see how these same factors save another life. We're going to be doing a deep dive into drowning resuscitation. I hope you'll join us. This has been the first episode of The Safety Break. It's a work in progress. It wouldn't have been possible without the technical advice and encouragement from my brother Kramer. He helped me figure out quite a few of the technical issues, but any bad music choices or other editing mistakes are all mine alone. Thanks again, Kramer. Thank you for listening to The Safety Break, the Whitewater Rescue Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, hit the subscribe button and click follow on our Facebook page so that we know that you're out there. I'm also looking for more stories. If you know of an interesting non-fatal river accident or rescue, send me a few details by email, safetybreak@gmail.com. It doesn't have to be dramatic or life-threatening, just something that we all might be able to learn from. I'll see if we can turn it into an episode. Stay safe out there, and I hope to see you on the river.